Nagarjuna, while paying homage to Buddha Shakyamuni, said, "I pay homage to Gautama Buddha, one who motivated by compassion in order to discard all wrong views, taught the sublime teachings." In order to help people cultivate the correct path, he gave countless teachings, out of which the essential teaching was how to cultivate the great compassion and the wisdom, realizing emptiness, and he himself actualized the state of omniscience through developing primarily these two qualities, and therefore he also told his students to cultivate these two qualities, the great compassion and bodhicitta. Therefore, we who are the followers of the Buddha should regard these twin practices as the heart practices. In order to develop and strengthen qualities like loving-kindness, compassion and bodhicitta, it is important to know the process and technique of such practices, and with regard to that we should hear the teaching, and particularly a correct, authentic teaching. And therefore here I'm conferring a brief explanation of Shantideva's text Bodhicharya Avatara. So today the weather is a little bit irritating, and we are getting drenched by the rain. In the past, when Kunchen Jamyang Sheba, he was receiving teaching from Siju Konjo Yarpil, and he got completely soaked by rain, and then later when he received the complete teaching, initiation and so on from Siju Konjo Yarpil, and then Kunchen Jamyang Sheba, Kunchen Jamyang Sheba later on remarked that when I received teachings from Siju Konjo Yarpil, I was externally soaked and internally soaked, meaning that externally he was soaked by rain and internally he was kind of soaked by the teaching. So in our case, internally I don't know, externally we are getting soaked today. However, I must tell you, in whatever way you can protect yourself, try to protect yourself. Do not make a pretension, make a show to others, pretending that you are undertaking a lot of hardship for the Dharma, and then you will become sick. So take good care of your health and make sure you don't fall sick. Verse 7. But Saman explains that the teachings of impermanence, teachings on teachings that things are conditioned, impermanence, are interpretative. So the verse 7, the first two lines of the verse 7 reads, this is a kind of reply to a question. A question is asked to the Madhyamikas by saying that if things are devoid of inherent existence and thereby they are non-existence, so therefore physical form and so forth are false, then why the Buddha has taught about impermanence and so on? And this is answered by saying that in order to help worldly beings gradually enter into the meaning of suchness, the protector has taught the meaning of things as impermanent and so on. But in the true meaning, in the true sense of the meaning, these things, they do not have a momentary existence in the sense of being inherently existent. Because such an answer is necessary, because a question is by asked by saying that to regard what is impure as pure, since what to see what is impure as pure is a wrong notion, and therefore to see what is impure as impure should be a correct view. So therefore these impure things should have inherent existence. And it is for the sake of understanding such, this is answered by saying that impermanence of things and so forth are taught by Buddha. So just as impermanent things do not exist permanently, therefore from the point of view of ultimate reality, there is no suffering, there is no impermanence, there is no pure, no impure, and so on. So from the point of view of ultimate reality and suchness, there is no such momentary existence. And then again, they try to refute this explanation by saying that this contradicts even the conventional reality. There is no such fault because from the point of view of a worldly contemplative person or a yogi realizes physical form and so forth as impermanent, and such impermanence of the physical form and so forth are realized by a worldly conventional direct perception. So worldly yogi here refers to someone who directly sees impermanence, and such a realization of direct impermanence is done by a conventional valid perception, and therefore it exists as it is, and therefore it is a correct view. And this is called correct view. So from the worldly point, from the ordinary worldly point of view, this is seeing the correct view, because from the point of view of the ordinary being, they tend to see what is impure as pure, and what is impermanent as permanent. So from that point of view, such a yogi has seen what is impermanent as impermanent. For example, in the case of ordinary worldly being, we tend to see women and so on as impure. So if that kind of realization is correct, then the worldly beings tend to see our body as pure. So if as is perceived by the worldly perception, if that is correct, then this should not be harmed by the perception of a yogi who sees our body as impure. And next is refuting the argument saying that if things do not exist inherently, then it is improper to accumulate merit, or it is impossible to accumulate merit. This is answered in verse 9 by saying that it is possible to collect merit, because from illusion like Buddha, illusion like merit is accumulated. So such a visualization is necessary even when we do a deity, a visualization of a deity, for example who is Tara or who is Avalokiteshvara and so on. So instead of trying to reflect on some of the mantras whose meaning we have no idea, it will be probably more helpful to recite some of these lines from Nagarjuna's fundamental wisdom and so on, and then reflect on the ultimate reality of the deities that you are visualizing, and then you are able to realize that they are like an illusion and doesn't have inherent existence. So when you search in this way, the object of your refuge and the one who goes to refuge, nothing is found. They are therefore all like illusion, and even in the case of the Buddha, it's like an illusion, and when you search, you can't find. So now this is misconstrued by the mindfulness school of thought and so on, by saying that if the Buddha is like illusion, then from such an illusion like Buddha, how will you collect merit? And this is answered by saying that by making offerings to a Buddha who is like an illusion, it is possible to accumulate merit. For example, in your own case, even though the Buddha doesn't have a true, in your case, when you accept Buddha as having true existence and then make offering to it, you accept that you accumulate merit. And just as in your case, you accept Buddha as having true existence, and in relation to that you make an offering which you accept as having true existence, and then from there you accumulate merit which also has true existence. Similarly, in my case, I see Buddha as an illusion, the offerings that I made as an illusion, and the merit that I accumulate is also like an illusion, and in that way I am able to collect merit. Then in the next two lines, again a question is raised: if things are like an illusion, then it is not possible to take conception. So if sentient beings are like an illusion, how would they be born after their death? This is answered by saying that verse number 10, as and when the causes and factors come together, then these illusions also arise. For example, even from the ordinary worldly parlance, you see things like mirage and dream and so on, which arise even though they are illusions, but they arise due to the collection of necessary causes and factors. So therefore, so long as the causes and factors come together, till that long the illusions also arise. So therefore, according to me, the Madhyamikas, even though things are devoid of inherent existence, fruits that are like an illusion are produced. And also you cannot make a distinction between our experience and illusion in a difference between them in terms of time. You might say that what we experience is for a long time and the illusions last for a short time. Even if you make such a differentiation, that is not a reason to defend your thesis. And again, questions are asked by saying that if things are illusion, then how virtue and sins are accumulated? Now in this case, an answer is given by saying verse number 11, when you imagine killing a person who is illusion and seeing that person as a person, and then with a wish to kill, if you kill that person, then there is the shortcoming and fault of actual practice, but there is no fault of actual killing because it doesn't have the mind. Just as in the case of a sentient being that possesses a mind like an illusion, if you benefit them, you accumulate merit, and if you harm them, you experience suffering. Verse number 12, mantras and so on doesn't have the power to produce mind, because the mind arises from their own causes and conditions and not through material substances or recitation of mantras. Not only in the case of sentient beings, even in the case of illusion, it is necessary to have the necessary causes and factors. So by depending upon various causes and factors, you also see different kinds of illusions, and therefore it is not possible to produce various things with just one cause. And then verse 13, if it is argued saying that if things doesn't have inherent existence, then we can't make a distinction between samsara and nirvana, or what is worldly and what is transcendental, they argue with the madhyamikas by saying that you are talking about natural liberation or natural transcendence of suffering, and you also posit that all phenomena lack inherent existence, therefore they naturally transcend in suffering, and therefore you are also saying that the samsara therefore is the samsara also from that point of view naturally transcends suffering, and this is so because everything is expression of emptiness. And if this is the case, how could you make a distinction between the samsara and the nirvana? Because even things like samsara that are defiled are also by nature without inherent existence. So whether it is samsara or suchness or nirvana, they all naturally transcend suffering. And even from that point of view, if you make a distinction between who wanders within the samsara, you could also say that the Buddha also wanders within the samsara. Then in that case, what is the use of making effort to achieve enlightenment? verse 14. This is answered by saying that the Madhyamikas do talk about lack of inherent existence of all phenomena, that everything naturally transcends suffering. But when we talk about everything naturally transcending suffering, and it is because of this state of natural transcendence of suffering, it is possible to actualize the nirvana with residue and the nirvana without residue. And it is because of the fact that everything naturally transcends suffering that we can develop positive counterforces and remove afflict emotions. So therefore, we cannot prove that everything is liberated or have achieved nirvana because their nature naturally transcends suffering. And in fact, we experience the suffering of samsara because of not seeing the ultimate reality of the natural transcendence of suffering. And as and when we are able to eliminate the misconception of reality that everything naturally transcends suffering, then the factors and the causes, the continuity of the stream of the factors cease, and then that state of cessation of the afflictive emotion is called nirvana. And if such continuity is not ceased, then what to talk about putting an end to samsara? You will not even able to put an end to the illusions. And when the continuity of the actions and afflictive emotions cease, and then the samsara, where birth and death are dependent, that also will not arise even at the conventional level. Verse 15 is refuting the mindfulness school of thought. The mindfulness schools of thought say that you, the Madhyamikas, are talking about lack of inherent existence of all phenomena. Then in that case, and not only you are talking about lack of inherent existence of the object, but also the subjective mind. But I can't accept this. If things do not have their inherent characteristics, then this is equal to non-existence. So whatever types of phenomena it is, they have all their characteristics, they have all their nature, either as good or as bad or as samsara or as nirvana. And it is because of this the term dharma is being applied. And therefore, if things do not have inherent nature, then what remains behind? So they get that kind of doubt and raise this question. And so this is a possible area of mistake in our case also, not simply just following the word, but if you really reflect on the meaning, then it's not so easy to understand, because we might confuse existence and inherent existence as equal. And that is exactly what the mindfulness schools of thought are asking the Madhyamikas, saying that if things do not have inherent existence, this is equal to saying that they do not have their inherent nature, that means they are non-existent. So this is a nihilistic point of view, and so long as there is an existence that can bring about benefit and harms, then they should have their inherent characteristic, inherent nature. So in this way, the mindfulness schools of thought debate or argue with the mindfulness school of thought, because the mindfulness school of thought accept inherent existence of all phenomena. And in fact, when they explain the dependent origination, which is one of the most important teaching of the Buddha, they primarily speak about they speak about cause-effect relationship, and not from other perspectives. So dependent origination for them means cause-effect relationship. So in the case of conditioned phenomena, you can derive benefit from them, you can receive harm from them, and so they believe that if things are not merely designated, there is goodness in the object and badness in the object, and it is because of this they have the capacity to produce fruit and results. So things are not just mentally designated, from the side of the object, they have the capacity to produce good results and bad results. And therefore, by using the reason of dependent origination, the mind only school of thought prove that things are not goodness and badness, samsara and nirvana, all these things are not just mentally designated, but there is an objective existence. And it is in this way they also interpret the meaning of Wisdom Perfection Sutra. The Wisdom Perfection explains that right from the form to the high state of omniscience, things do not have existence. This is explained by the mindless school of thought, saying that it is not the ultimate thought of the Buddha to say that they do not have inherent existence. And that's why they talk about three natures of all objects and phenomena. And first of all, they talk about a basis, like a pot, which is called other dependent phenomena. And then on that they talk about another quality which is called totally imputed phenomena, and then a third nature which is called thoroughly established or thoroughly proved phenomena. So it is this thoroughly established phenomena which they identify as emptiness. So when we take an object like a pot as the basis, as the foundation, so that is actually one nature. And this object, the other dependent phenomena as the foundation, seems to exist from its own side. So it does not exist as it appears to us. And so the lack of the absence of imputed phenomena on the other dependent phenomena or object or basis is called thoroughly established phenomena, and that is the emptiness from the point of view of the mindful school of thought. And therefore, if we think about even the title mindful school of thought, they analyze a lot and investigate a lot of the object, and when they analyze the object and split the object into parts, when they are unable to find it, then they would say that things are not existent, and therefore they say there is no externally existent object. And in the case of the internal mind, even in the case of the mind, we can analyze in the same process by splitting the mind into parts of the first and succeeding moments and so on. But without being able to do that, they affirm an independently existent mind. And since the experience of the internal mind is extremely strong, and therefore they see this as something very powerful, and therefore they believe this as having true existence and as having inherent existence, and therefore the mindless schools of thought refute external existence, but at the same time they affirm a truly existent internal mind. And therefore they refute and deny external existence and accept the consciousness and the mind as having true existence. And the mindfulness school of thought argue with the Madhyamikas by saying that you are talking about the lack of inherent existence of both the object and the subjective mind. And it is okay that you refer to the inherent existence of the object, but tell me, which is this mind that knows it? Which is this mind that perceives the illusion like a form? And even if that mind doesn't exist, because you accept that as having no inherent existence, and then This amounts to say things are merely designated, and then just as the external object is non-existent, similarly if the mind is non-existent, and then which is this mind that perceives this illusion-like objects like the form? So this is how they argue. This is answered by saying, according to you, the mind will schools of thought, just as objects like a form, if they exist, if they have an external existence as it appeared to you, then you have to accept externally existent object. And if this illusion like form and so on, and if you say that external objects like form exist as they appear to you, then how can you say that they are like an illusion, because they exist as they appear to you? Now if they do not exist, or if they do not have inherent existence or true existence as they appear to you, then this is equal to total non-existence. Then in that case, what is it that you have perceived it? And this is answered by the mind-only school of thought by saying that even though there is no externally existent object as is perceived by the mind or as it appears to the mind, in other words, there is no substantially separate object from the mind, but there is another way of its existence. So an external object, when it is perceived by the mind, they are perceived because of the activation of the imprints of the mind, and therefore these objects exist as of one substance, as of same substance with the mind that perceives it. And this is again answered by the Madhyamika school of thought by saying, and if this mind is of same substance with the object that is like an illusion, and in that case you can't make a distinction between the object that is being perceived and the mind that perceives it. In other words, if it is just the mind, when you talk about what is being perceived by the mind, if you say that this is just a reflection of the mind itself, then in that case, how could you make a distinction between the object that has been perceived and the one that perceives the object? So if it has a true existence, then it could be none other than the mind itself, and therefore you can't make a distinction between the seer and what is being seen. And it is not possible that one could see oneself, as is taught by the Lord of the world, that means Buddha, where he says the mind cannot see the mind itself. That means the mind cannot see the mind without dualistic appearances. Just as the blade of a sword or sharpness of the sword cannot cut itself. And similarly, if you use logic and reason, and when we talk about what is being seen and the seer and the cutter and that which has been cut, these two should be seen as separate. And one that cuts cannot be seen as the same to that which has been cut. So therefore it is not possible that the same mind can see itself without dualistic appearances. And this is answered by the mind-only school of thought by saying that there is no fault in this, because just in the case of the butter lamp, it illuminates itself and also illuminates the object. So similarly, the mind also sees the object and also sees itself. So there is a self-cognitive part as well as a cognitive part that sees the object. And this is again refuted by the Madhyamikas by saying that it is wrong to say that the butter lamp lights itself or illuminates itself. And if you are able to accept that, then you should also say that the darkness obscures itself. And this is again answered by the Mahindra school. Now, in the case of now, if you compare a crystal which reflects a blue color, in that case, the blue color that you see in the crystal, or the crystal becoming blue, is dependent on the other color blue. And in the case of lapis lazuli, the blueness in that lapis lazuli is not dependent on others because it is by nature blue. So similarly, there are things like that within the human mind. There are some minds which are dependent on the object, and there are others which are not dependent on object, like form and so on. So there are kinds of mind which are dependent on object, like a form and so on, and then there are other minds. Which are kind of introvert, which focuses within, and there you can't make a distinction between the seer and what is being seen. Those kinds of minds which perceives an external object, which are dependent on external object, and then there are others which are not dependent. And this is again refuted by saying, if the blueness is not produced by the cause, then it cannot create itself as become blue. And without seeing the object, you cannot talk about the clarity of the mind. Just in the case of a son of a barren woman, because such a son of barren woman doesn't exist, therefore you cannot talk about the beauty of the son of the barren woman. And again, the mind only school of thought argues with Madhyamikas. I'm reading verse 23, where he says that the fact of being able to remember something that the mind has experienced earlier is due to self-cognition. And if there is no self-cognition, then it's not possible to remember or recollect what one has done in the past. And if there is no self-cognition, then it's not possible to remember the consciousness. And this is answered by the Madhyamikas by saying that there is no such self-cognition. Because even if there is no self-cognition, but through the experiencing of an object like a form, and because of the connection between the subject mind and subject to mind, the object, one will be able to remember what one has experienced. For example, in the case of a rat, if a rat gets poisoned, and at that particular point the rat may not know that it has been poisoned, but later on one is able to know that one has been poisoned in relation to the experiencing of the object. And again, this is argued by the Mindfulness School of Thought by saying that by depending on other factors like strong meditative stabilization, one is able to see things at a very long distance, like other people's being able to read other people's mind and so on, and therefore why not one is able to have such self-cognition or understanding of one's own mind, which is so close and so near. And this is answered by saying that this is also not a definite reason, because through the power of certain medical substances, sometimes we are able to see things that are hidden deep under the ground, but one is not able to see the eye medicine itself, which is lying there just on the eye. Verse 25, the Mindfulness School of Thought again refutes by saying that you are talking about the lack of inherent existence of all phenomena, whether it's the object or the subject mind or the emptiness itself. So the Mindfulness School of Thought are saying that it is really not good to make such a presentation that all things are devoid of inherent existence. Because if there is no self-cognition, and then there is no cognition of other objects, then in that case there will be no seeing, hearing and so on. And this is refuted by the Mindfulness School of Thought, that this is incorrect argument, because when I talk about things having no inherent existence, I am not saying that things do not exist at all. Things very much exist, and they exist like an illusion, again in the sense of having no inherent existence. And having no independent existence means that they exist dependently. When they exist dependently, they definitely exist, and therefore there is hearing, thinking and so on. And therefore I'm not refuting what is being seen, what is being heard, and we experience these things, and there is no disagreement about that, and therefore the Madhyamikas are not refuting this. But what we are refuting is that whether it is the object that we see or the internal experience of the mind, when we see those objects and develop certain internal experiences, we tend to see them as having inherent and independent existence, and then we make a lot of mistakes. So therefore I am refuting such independent inherent existence, and such perception of things as having independent or inherent existence is not only a misconception of reality, but such misconception of reality creates a lot of sufferings and problems, and therefore it is important to understand the reality, the lack of inherent existence of all phenomena. So therefore what I am refuting is the causes of sufferings. The causes of suffering is to see everything as having true existence, that is the ignorance which is being refuted. And in the 400 verses by Aryadeva also, he says that the seat of the samsara is the consciousness, and the objects are its field of engagement. And when you are able to see those objects as having no inherent existence, then one gets liberated. And a similar statement is made by Nagarjuna, that is, by seeing things as having independent or inherent existence, that we develop hatred, anger and so on. And I have earlier also recited the quotation from Nagarjuna's Fundamental Wisdom, where he says that by putting an end to actions and afflict emotions, we get liberated. How is it that we get liberated from putting an end to actions and afflict emotions? This is so because actions and afflict emotions from misconceptions of the reality or conceptual thoughts. And misconceptions of the reality arises from true grasping. In other words, misconception of the reality arises from fabrication. Now when we talk about fabrication, there are different levels of meaning. One is fabrication in the sense of subject-object duality, and fabrication also in the sense of seeing things, fabrication also in the sense of object of negation, or seeing things as having true existence, and fabrication also in the sense of conventional experiences, and sometimes even emptiness is referred as a fabrication. And sometimes when we talk about emptiness free from fabrications, there are comments which says that it is not possible to have emptiness totally in isolation with being free from the fabrications of the object. So here we are when we talk about fabrication, we are refers to the fabrication of the object of negation, which is true existence. And when we perceive the object as having true existence, then that's a fabrication, because there's no such truly existent object, and it's fabrication of the conceptual thought. And because of our past habituation with certain negative imprints, we tend to grasp at things and tend to see them as having true existence. And that kind of fabrication can be eliminated by developing the wisdom that realizes emptiness. So there are two ways of explaining this. You can also interpret this by saying that such fabrications are ceased by the wisdom realizing emptiness, and you can also interpret this by saying that such fabrications can be eliminated into the nature of emptiness. And that's why I have always been telling people that it is not important or it is not enough that things by their nature are primordially pure. What is important is to also realize the spontaneity of the phenomena and objects. And similarly, it is not enough that things are devoid of inherent existence. We need to know that state of emptiness based on our experience. When I received the commentary of Nagarjuna's Fundamental Wisdom from the late master Kundalama Rinpoche, he he told me these two ways of interpreting. One is to say that all fabrications can be put to an end by the wisdom realizing emptiness, or you can interpret it by saying that all fabrications will cease into the emptiness. That means that in the state of emptiness there is no fabrication, there is no subject-object duality, and therefore you can put an end to such fabrications by making your mind habituated with the wisdom realizing emptiness and by strengthening and developing it. And it is in this way that you can put an end to the misconception of the reality. And therefore here in this verse 25, the Madhyamikas are saying that I am refuting inherent existence to refute true existence, and I am not refuting the subject to mind that perceives the object like a form, and I am also not refuting the object. And earlier we discussed about three types of mind. There is one mind which perceives the object characterizing that it has true existence, and then there is also a mind which simply perceives the object without characterizing it as having true existence or without true existence. And then there is one way of perceiving the object as seeing it having no true existence. So what I'm trying to say is, to see a pot as a pot is fine, there's nothing wrong with that. And there is also nothing wrong seeing Buddha as a Buddha and seeing the qualities of the Buddha as the qualities of the Buddha. The problem arises if you tend to see them as having true existence as they appear to us, because things do not have such objective existence. And things do not have such objective existence because they are interdependent on causes and factors and so on. And there is one line which reads that if things have objective existence, then what is the role of designation? What is the need for them to depend on others? And this is absolutely true. And if you reflect on the many designations and conventions that we terms and that we use, and many of the terms and designations that we use really are baseless, and we give designation to something that has happened in the past and gone, and we give designation to something that's yet to come, and all these designations are done as is renowned to others, and apart from that you don't have any object which you can pinpoint and lay your fingers on. And since it is possible in certain areas, why can't we have that in other areas as well? And therefore things are designated, things appear to us as is known to the designating mind. And if things on the other hand have objective and inherent existence, then what is the role of the designating mind? You can simply point that out and say this is the objective reality. But the thing is that when we try to pinpoint any object and try to lay our hands on it, we really are unable to pinpoint that, and that disappear. This clearly shows that things are designated. And since all things are designated, not only the conditioned objects and conditioned phenomena, but all objects of knowledge, all phenomena, all existent objects, if you analyze them, nothing is found. They are not findable, and therefore they are designated only. And there's no existence apart from what's dependent on designation. And this is the reality. However, the problem is that when things appear to us, they do not appear to us as they are merely designated, but they appear to us as having objective existence, independent existence. And this is true either in the case of the object or in the case of the perceiving subjective mind. And such an understanding is extremely important. Now, for example, when you focus on one particular object, whether it's a material object or a living sentient being. And in the beginning, when you focus on that object, the appearance or that it has objective and independent existence is there right from the beginning. And then you should see what is your mode of perception when you perceive that object. And of course, every time when things appear to us, they appear to us as having inherent existence. And particularly when you enter into a particular object, particularly when you perceive a particular object at the time when you develop strong attachment and hatred, then you should judge carefully what is your mode of perception, what is your viewpoint, and what is your perspective towards that object. I think it is important to highlight that experience. And if you relate this to your own experience, then you will be able to find that out. Now, when we develop strong attachment, then we see the good qualities, the attractive qualities in the object. We see those attractive objects. We not only see such attractive objects in the attractive qualities in the object, but it seems that we tend to see those attractive qualities in the object as having independent and true existence. And that's why when we develop a clear indication is that sometimes the object to whom you had so much attachment, and when suddenly that person performs some negative action, you simply can't trust and believe it. And you will be shocked with surprise, saying that how come such a person does such a negative act, clearly showing that you had a strong grasping of that person's quality, seeing that as if it has independent inherent existence. And if it has independent inherent such good quality, then of course it shouldn't change. And that's what you have been expecting. And suddenly later on when you see changes in that person, you almost disbelieve it. So therefore, when we develop strong attachment and when we develop strong hatred, then such perceptions are supported and assisted by ignorance. So therefore it will be very useful to observe such experiences. And therefore that's what is being said by the Madhyamikas here. When we, the Madhyamikas, are very stubbornly talking about lack of inherent existence, we are talking so that we are able to remove the sufferings, remove the causes of sufferings of sentient beings. And Umapas, therefore, are not stupid people or senseless people, and they are very sharp and very contemplative. And for example, in the Heart Sutra, the Buddha himself has says that you should see the five psychophysical aggregates as having no inherent existence. And he goes into detail by saying that there's no form, sound, and so on. And he also says that there's no suffering, no happiness, no true path, and no true cessation. And then he also says that all the Buddhas of the present, past, and future achieves enlightenment by realizing the lack of inherent existence. So he is saying that he is not talking that things do not have existence at all. That's why he is saying that by meditating on true inherent lack of true existence, one achieves enlightenment. So there is function of cause and effect. Again, in verse 26, the mindfulness schools of thought argue by saying that the illusion-like objects which are other than the mind are not of different substance to the mind. In other words, apart from the mind, there is no externally existent object. And I'm also not saying that these objects are not also, I'm not saying that these objects are also mind. And therefore, these objects are kind of inexpressible. And we cannot express it as other in the sense of totally substantially separate from the mind, and they are also not the mind, so therefore they are inexpressible. And this is refuted by the Madhyamikas by saying that if they exist, then they should be substantially different from the mind. And if they do not exist as they appear, then they are false, and therefore can't have true existence. And according to you, the mind only school of thought, and the object, which is like an illusion, even though it doesn't have true existence, still it's the object of perception of the mind. And in that case, even the subjective mind, even though it doesn't exist truly, you can accept that as having conventional existence. Or in other words, you should also accept the mind that perceives the object as false, as having no existence as it appears to us. In other words, you should maintain a similar understanding in relation to both the object and subject, why you make a distinction between the object and the subjective mind that perceives the object. Because the mindful schools of thought have been saying that the object, like a form, doesn't have true existence, whereas the subjective mind that perceives the object has true existence. And in case, all the Buddhist schools of thought make a presentation on the designated phenomena and the substantially existent phenomena, and whichever is a designated phenomena, it should be dependent on a substantially existent phenomena. And therefore I said yesterday that a person is a designated phenomena, and therefore it should be dependent on a substantially existent phenomena. And therefore things like samsara and those that are designated, if they are dependent on a substantially existent or truly existent phenomena, and if this is not the case, and otherwise all these designated phenomena will become like a space, meaning that they will become non-existent. Verse 28. So this argument by the mindfulness school of thought are refuted by Madhyamikas in verse 28. Such non-existent object, meaning the designated object, when they depend on a substantially existent object, or for example in the case of the samsara, if it is dependent on a truly existent object, and then it would become an object that cannot be changed. And in that case, what is the role of the function of the cause, and what is the function of the cause and the effects? So how could functions can make them change? And therefore, in the case of you, the materialist, or the mindless school of thought. In your case, your mind is one without support, and it will become alone. It will only become a self-cognition, and there will be no object that your mind can perceive. Verse 29, and therefore if the mind is without an object, and in that case everybody should get enlightened. In other words, if the mind of being in the samsara, if it is from the duality of the subject and object, and then at that time all sentient beings from the beginningless time should be enlightened, because they are the one who is free from any types of fabrication, and so all should be enlightened. However, in order to achieve enlightenment, in order to remove ignorance, in that case, what is the use of talking about removing ignorance and achieving enlightenment? It has started raining heavily, and I also need to see some people, so we stop the morning session here.